This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and when I start my workday, it always begins with that morning shower. Normally, I use a liquid body wash, but recently I purchased a bar of Sterling Soap Company's handcrafted bath soap and decided to give their Deep Blue Sea handcrafted bath soap a try. Immediately, the aroma of Sterling's bath soap was obvious, and in using this soap, I felt refreshed, clean, energized, and Sterling's bath soap helped me step out of that shower with the momentum and eagerness to get my day rolling. If you want to get a refreshing wake-up call in the morning and get your busy day off to the right start, I highly recommend going to Sterling Soap Company's website and order one of their many varieties of bath soaps among other products they offer. Visit Sterling Soap Company at sterlingsoap.com. That's STIRLING soap.com.
Hi, welcome to today's podcast, The Patriots from Boston to Foxborough. I'm your host, Joe Santos. In part two, we will discuss the period from 1969 to 1970, which may go down as the strangest in the Patriots' history. Not only did the team move stadiums in 1969, but they also parted ways with head coach Mike Hollaback. During this time, the team was still fighting to gain relevancy with the Boston fan base, as the Sox were coming off the impossible dream season of 1967 and a World Series appearance. The Celtics had a dynasty and were in the middle of winning 11 championships in 13 years. And the Bruins had a budding superstar named Bobby Orr, who was about to take his team to new heights and make hockey very popular in New England. In his bid to put the Patriots in the headlines, Billy Sullivan tried to lure legendary coach Vince Lombardi to Boston. Lombardi was itching to get back into coaching after retiring the year before. Sullivan offered to make Lombardi the highest paid coach in the league and promised to throw in 30,000 non-voting shares of Patriots stock. The problem for Sullivan and the Pats was Lombardi's lawyer, Edgar Bennett Williams, who was also the president of the Washington Redskins, who also needed a head coach. So when Washington offered Lombardi the head coaching job, partial ownership of the team, and the chance to play golf with the President of the United States and other D.C. notables, the Pats were out of the running. Even though they had offered Lombardi much more money, it seems that hanging out with Billy Sullivan just didn't carry the same cachet. After getting spurned by Lombardi, Sullivan was turned down by USC's John McKay and would turn his sights to the hot coaching prospects from the teams who had played in Super Bowl III, who were Chuck Knoll, a top assistant for the Colts head coach Don Shula, and Cleve Rush, the Jets offensive coordinator. Sullivan liked both men, but was heavily influenced by Jets quarterback Joe Namath and his endorsement of Rush as a quote-unquote hell of a coach. It never dawned on Sullivan as to why Namath would want to see his offensive coordinator leave the team after they had just won the Super Bowl. Sullivan was probably unaware that Rush wanted the Jets to draft Craig Morton instead of Namath. In what would turn out to be one of the worst blunders in team's history, the Patriots hired Rush, thinking in part that getting the coach who was on the winning team from the Super Bowl would play more favorably in the Boston press instead of hiring the coach from the losing team. Oh boy, big mistake. Sullivan should have done his homework. Chuck Knoll would go on to coach the Steelers to four Super Bowl championships on his way to getting enshrined in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and is generally regarded as one of the best NFL coaches of all time. Conversely, Cleve Rush's time in Boston was doomed from the start. In a scene that would come to symbolize the Cleve Rush era, at a press conference to introduce the team's new general manager, George Sauer Sr., Rush was nearly electrocuted by Hot Mike. As soon as Rush touched the microphone, he was unable to let go and began screaming. It was only the rapid reactions of Pat's board member Don Marr Jr. that saved him. According to the Globe's Will McDonough, while Rush was screaming in anguish and staggering into a corner, unable to free himself from the microphone which could have electrocuted him, Marr jumped from his seat and ripped out the wiring along the floor out of the wall sockets, shutting off the current. When he was finally able to let go of the microphone, Rush was helped away from the podium and was immediately attended to. "The shock went up one arm, across the shoulders, and down the other," said Dr. John Knight, who examined Rush shortly afterward. "If it had gone to his heart, it would have been very serious." Rush tried to brush it off by saying, quote-unquote, "I heard about the Boston press being tough, but I didn't think they're going to be this tough." And it only got worse from there, as it was later revealed that Rush was battling both alcoholism and depression. Perhaps this is why he would make some of the most head-scratching moves in league history in a tenure that was both bizarre and tragic. How else to explain trading away one of the best team's best players, Nick Bonacani, who was from Massachusetts, to Miami and get nothing in return? Like Noel, Bonacani would also get inducted to the Hall of Fame. Not surprisingly, Rush's first season started with 7 straight losses, and the Pats would finish their last year in the AFL with a 4-10 record. During the course of the season, Rush performed a succession of strange things as described by legendary Boston Globe sports writer Lee Montville. Rush once waited outside a dressing room after a game to pick a fight with Buffalo Bills assistant coach. He also would switch players from offense to defense and defense to offense, made them play positions they had never played, and then switch them back again. He created a quote-unquote black power defense, which consisted of 11 African Americans on the field at once, that he claimed would solve the country's racial problems. It didn't. In another incident, following a loss in Week 13 against the Chargers in San Diego, Rush demanded the bus driver to drive down the off-ramp of a California freeway in the opposite direction in order to punish the players. "We hung on for our lives," said one of the players. The Boston College and Holy Cross graduates began to say Hail Marys as the bus sputtered along the highway with the cars whizzing by the other way. Fortunately, the team survived this and no one was injured. Rush's routine would be to come off the practice field in the afternoon and pour himself a premium scotch as soon as he entered his office and chain smoke Kent cigarettes, which would put him in the right frame of mind to challenge the local sports writers. Montville, who was the Globe's beat writer covering the Patriots, said Rush would call his home and tell his wife he was going to start a lawsuit against her husband because he didn't like the negative publicity in the press. "Who's your lawyer?" Rush would ask, to which Montville's wife would reply, "We don't have a lawyer." "Well, you better get one," Rush would say, "because my lawyer is Marvin Belli, and I'm calling him to start a lawsuit against your husband. I don't want to take all your money, but I have to." This prompted Montville to ask his colleague at the Globe, Will McDonough, if all NFL coaches behaved like Rush. McDonough admitted he too would get those threatening calls from Rush and told Montville that Rush was cuckoo, that's what he is. In an effort to improve both the team's and coach's performance for the upcoming 1970 season, Patriots management convinced Rush to spend some time at a Mass General Hospital in the offseason for fatigue. When the team opened the season on September 20, 1970, in their first NFL game with a 27-14 win over the Miami Dolphins, which was Don Shula's first as Miami's head coach, the offseason strategy seemed to have paid off. However, even in victory, there was strangeness. Consider the stories of Bob Gladue and John Outlaw. Hours before the kickoff, two of the team's players got into a contract dispute with team owner Billy Sullivan, who promptly tore up their contracts and kicked them off the team. The Pats were now forced to scramble to come up with two replacements in order to compete to complete the roster. Sullivan mentions reinstating two players who had recently been cut, Gladue and Outlaw. The team was able to quickly reach Outlaw and tell him to get to Curry College, which was 15 minutes away, pick up a uniform and report to Harvard Stadium ASAP, which Outlaw does. Arriving in full uniform but without a ticket, the security guard at the gate refuses to allow Outlaw into the stadium, but compliments him on what he perceived to be an elaborate scheme to try and get into a sold-out game by coming dressed as a Patriots player. Eventually, Outlaw is able to track down a security guard who contacts one of the coaches and is led into the stadium. With Outlaw now in the fold, the team was now trying to get track down Gladue, who found out he had been released only a few days earlier by watching the local news. Although he was no longer on the team, Gladue decided to attend the game and was drinking beers with friends when, shortly before kickoff, Sullivan, who had a hunch Gladue might be at the game, got on the loudspeaker and said, "If Bob Gladue is in the stands, please report to the locker room." Not only does Gladue fill out the roster, but he makes the game's first tackle on the opening kickoff. The win over Miami would prove to be the high point of the season. The team tried to improve their play at quarterback and acquired former Vikings quarterback Joe Capp, who had led Minnesota to the Super Bowl the prior season. Due to a contractual dispute with the Vikings, App was a free agent for the 1970 season, and on October 2nd, the Pats signed him to a four-year contract and made him the highest-paid player in the league. They also gave up a defensive back and a 1972 first-round draft pick. Now, if you're thinking this was a lot to give up for one player, that's because it was, especially when you consider the fact that no other team in the league had even bothered to reach out to Cap prior to the season. What would make this trade look even worse was the 1972 first-round draft pick the Pats gave up to get him turned out to be linebacker Jeff Seaman, who would be the Vikings' starting linebacker on their Super Bowl teams in the 70s. As you'll soon hear, the Patriots got close to nothing for their investment in Cap, as he did little to turn the Pats' fortunes around in 1970 and was out of football completely prior to the 1971 season when he refused to sign a standard contract. 1970 season would continue to spin out of control, as evidenced at a midweek press conference that took place at a local restaurant, where Coach Russ said his assistant coaches would be replaced by the local sports writers and proceeded to read a list of the jobs for different writers. Montevil was named as coach in charge of offensive formations, dog psychology, and waiver procedures and league rules. Rush left the presser without taking questions. Prior to the upcoming home game against the Bills, Rush said he felt dizzy, so Sullivan and the team doctor advised him to stay in his room at the Ramada Inn, where the team dressed for its home games. Listening to the game on the radio in his hotel room for the first half, Rush decided he had had enough and walked across the parking lots and appeared on the sidelines for the final 30 minutes of a 45-10 blowout loss. The day after the loss, Rush met with Sullivan and other team officials at his home, where they encouraged him to take some time off. On Tuesday, the Pats made the official announcement that Rush had taken the medical leave of absence. Approximately an hour later, Rush showed up at his office and told the press the Patriots had it all wrong, announced his resignation from the team, and said he'd never coach them again. As he made this announcement, he was holding a small dog and asked Ron Hobson of the Quincy Patriot Ledger to hold the dog for a moment, which Hobson did. He then immediately tried to take a punch at legendary Channel 5 sportscaster Clark Booth. A fittingly bizarre ending to an extremely bizarre career as Patriots head coach. Rush died in 1980 of a heart attack at the age of 49. John Mazur, who was the team's offensive backfield coach, replaced Rush as head coach for the final seven games and finished the year at 1-6, which was identical to Rush's, and the team went 2-12 in their final season in Boston. Don't forget to join us for part three of the Patriots from Boston to Foxborough, as we examine the team's first year in Foxborough and hear intimate accounts from the team's general manager, Upton Bell, on some of the behind-the-scenes stories that occurred during his tenure there. You can find this and many other great podcasts on the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the history of your favorite sport. I'm your host, Joe Santos. Thanks for listening.